Sarah Kemp of The Wine Conversation, and today I'm talking to Jasper Morris, Master of Wine and World Authority on Burgundy. Jasper started working in the wine world in 1979 and started the company Morris & Verdon, the Burgundy Specialists, which was sold to Berry Brothers & Rudd in 2003. Jasper stayed with Berry Brothers as the Burgundy buyer to 2017 when he retired. He became a Master of Wine in 1985 and is regarded today as one of the greatest authorities on Burgundy. In 2010, he wrote Inside Burgundy, a magnum opus which won the prestigious André Simon Prize. And he has just published the second edition, which is why I'm delighted to talk to him today. So, Jasper, welcome to The Wine Conversation.
Hello, Sarah. Good to talk to you.
Well, it's great to talk to you. It seems only yesterday when you published the first edition, I couldn't actually believe it was 2010. The new edition is just out. Can you tell me what's changed since the first edition? What are the major changes in Burgundy?
Well, I've changed as part of it. Obviously, 11 years older, but also I no longer work with a commercial bent, commercial hat on. And that, of course, was something which I had to be careful about in the first edition because it needed not to be seen as just praise for the growers who we worked with. And pretty much everybody was very happy to accept that. I made sure I declared the conflict of interest, and I don't think people saw it in that way. But I was deliberately careful not to give too much opinion as to which producers I preferred and which I didn't, that you could probably read between the lines. And in fact, I've still used more or less that technique because it's not appropriate for this particular sort of book to say this person's great and that person's horrible and give lots of scores and so on. But obviously, it's fairly clear who are the people who I think are absolutely sensational. So that's one aspect. But also in my previous life, I got to see the people I worked with every year and various other top names I would probably go and visit most years. But my acquaintance was not as wide as it is today. And since 2017, I've been able to go and see all sorts of different people, some I didn't even know existed back then, and others who I was aware of, but I'd never had the opportunity to go and see. So that's a change from my point of view. Otherwise, the two main talking points on, there are various technical changes that's happened in Burgundy, but the two main things will be related to global warming and to pricing. So we can certainly come into those in due course. I've in this second edition, I've also made a point of going much more deeply into the lesser well-known areas. They all got covered, at least in part, in the first edition, but nonetheless, understandably, the more famous villages got the lion's share. And since then, I've taken a lot of time and trouble to go to places like Montilly, Saint-Romain, Sidiures, in the Côte de Beaune, Marcenay-Fussin, the Côte de Nuit, a lot more in the Mâconnais, a lot more, not just in Chablis, but in the areas around it, what we tend loosely to call the Auxerrois. So appellations like Irancy and Vézelay and various other forms of Bourgogne up there, and so on and so forth. I would love to have been able to add Beaujolais, but we ran a little bit out of time and completely out of space, because it turns out, at least for a book of the size of mine in shape of page, it turns out there is an absolute maximum of 800 pages before you have to have it bound by hand, which completely changes the pricing. So we've got to 800 pages even without the Beaujolais. So that was forced on me, because it would have been nice to include them. So there's greater depth in all those areas in the second edition. There are many more individual domains which are examined. I have been able to include a few more vineyards in a slightly greater depth than first time round. And then I've obviously rewritten in the first section, totally rewritten the chapter on climate, quite a few other things. The winemaking chapters have changed a lot as well. History less so. Geology has changed a lot, not because it's changed, but because I've understood it better. It's really hard, the geology, because each time I've gone into it, I've understood it just well enough to think that I know what it's about, but not well enough to be able to express it to other people. And I took a bit more of a step forward, and I think I'm a bit closer to that this time around.
Well, climate change obviously is the topic of the moment. We can't get away from it. And of course, it's caused major problems in the last few vintages in Burgundy with hail. What are the producers doing in the vineyard and in the cellars? Are there changes they're making in response to this, Jasper?
Yes. First of all, to put a little bit of flesh on the bones of what climate change has actually meant, because it's been coming for a while, clearly. And we already knew about it at the time of the first edition, but it wasn't yet being aggressive. We'd had outlying vintages like 2003, which were extreme, and plenty of other sort of hot, dry years, but it wasn't yet a game changer. Then we went through a period in which you mentioned hail. That was actually, the last few years, we've been spared the hail for the most part. And it may be because they put some measures in place, such as putting up sort of stations which can shoot at the potential hail clouds and fill them up with other things and make them come down as rain rather than as hail. It's very hard to prove a negative, so we don't know for sure if they've worked or if just patterns have changed anyway. But 12, 13, 14 were years of totally miserable hail damage. And then from 16 onwards, we have had this very strong frost threat, which of course, superficially, you would think, why are we getting frost if everything's getting warmer? But it's just changing the patterns of airflow so that we now risk getting huge masses of cold air, which used to be kept up in the Arctic. Now the polar air currents are much weaker than they used to be. And so now they're sliding down, not just into Burgundy, but Europe in general. And indeed, even this year, Texas got a freeze, the same sort of thing from the US point of view. And so big frosts in 16 and 21, fairly serious frosts in parts of Burgundy in 17 and 19. So, and even 18 and 20, it came close, but didn't happen. So that is now a new worry. So what do you do about it? And the other thing we should say is that not in 2021, which is a throwback to how things were before, but fairly much standard from 17, 18, 19, 20, the wind patterns have changed. We've had less of the classic sou'wester, which of course is, though it's warm, is also wet. We've tended to have either north winds or south winds. So north is cold and south is hot, but both of them are dry. So we've had a prolonged period of drought, and we have had, during the summer months, most years, noticeably higher temperatures than in the past. So people have got to manage extreme weather events plus a general hotter and drier climate. So what do you do? There are a few things you can put in place against the extreme weather events. You can look at forms of netting for hail, which is hard to be sure about, and it's still experimental. I've mentioned the sort of the cannon type things, which seed the clouds, which may have worked. But in terms of the frost, everybody is still scratching their heads because it's this frost in 2021, which has made people realize quite how serious it is. Now, we know that Chablis can protect itself against frost. They use water aspersion. They use smudge pots or candles, bougie in French. And now people are starting to lay electric cables. Chablis gone ahead and done that because they've always had this bigger frost damage. The question is, can we now use those same methods in Burgundy proper? And they are pretty expensive to put into place, and you need to have a large water supply. In Chablis, they even built an entire reservoir with the intention of using it for that purpose. If you want to put the electric cables down, you've then got to put sort of an electric substation at the foot of the vineyard that you're using. The cabling itself costs a lot. The electricity you use costs a lot. And it's an expensive option, but it may be used in a few places. People are reluctant to use the smudge pots or candles to the same extent they have been, because frankly, it depends exactly what fuel you use, but it is petrochemical at base and it does give off a polluting cloud as well. So some organic people refuse to use them even now, and others are trying to find another solution. You can also use wind turbines, which don't work in these really cold frosts, but would work if you build into that a heating system so it is actively warm air that's being pumped around. And a number of producers have bought mobile ones, which they can sort of trundle from one vineyard to another or just use them wherever they're necessary. That's something we'll see a bit more of. But it's a little bit alarming and something to watch. In terms of your viticulture, you have it's reacting against the heat and the drought, which is probably more important. And that's very interesting. A few people want to make dramatic changes. Some people even want to change the grape varieties, which I think is crazy. I mean, can you imagine paying the money that you pay for Premier Cru and Grand Cru Burgundy? Well, it's hard to imagine paying that money anyway, but can you imagine doing that if the red wines were made with a grape other than Pinot Noir? I mean, it's just not going to happen, is it? Your Musigny is not going to be Musigny with another grape. In white, there's a suggestion which I like a lot, which is to allow a certain percentage of Aligoté into the standard Chardonnay-based vineyards. And I think that works well because Aligoté is properly begun the long history. It takes longer to ripen. It doesn't ripen to the same excessive degrees as Chardonnay can do, and it brings freshness and acidity. And the people who started making single vineyard Aligotés have shown that it is, as the French would say, transparent in the way that it portrays terroir in the same way that Chardonnay does. And of course, there is a historical precedent. There used to be a lot more Aligoté in the more famous vineyards than is currently the case. So I see no problem with that at all. People want to start irrigating. My first reaction is negative to that, simply because if you allow it at all, then the good old boys are going to do it systematically too much and sort of every year, and they're just going to use it to bolster their crop rather than as a technique to save vineyards from actively dying. So I wouldn't particularly go down that route. Canopy management is crucial. Here again, it's a little bit counterintuitive, because if you think about the whole of France, down in the south, Châteauneuf-du-Pape, you have your vines very close to the ground. Up in the cooler north, let's say Alsace, you have vines which can be up to 2 meters tall. And so in general in the world, greater heat means lower vine canopy. But in Burgundy, with the extra heat, there's a whole school of thought which is raising the canopy much higher. Partly it's to give more leaf shading and mean that the fruiting zone is a little cooler. And then you have to guard against, you have to think, what puts the sugar in the grapes? It's not the direct sun on the grapes, which you clearly don't want at the moment, as the sun is going to be hotter. But of course, it's photosynthesis. So if you have to have, if you have more leaves, you risk having greater photosynthesis and therefore higher sugar levels. So you've got to manage it in such a way that you have got leaves which do not bring extra sugar. You've also got a question of whether or not you are going to get greater evaporation through enhanced leaf system. And there are different theories. So it's all work in progress. And I don't think we can say at the moment that clearly one idea or another idea is better. People have got to experiment and find out what's going to work. The other thing which is really tedious is that some of the rootstocks which are being used in Burgundy are just failing completely. There's one really important one called 16149C, which used to be the preferred one, especially in the white wine vineyards, but a little bit throughout Burgundy. It suddenly stopped working. It's a little bit shallow rooted of nature. And if the top part of the soils are drying out, then it's just not doing its job anymore. It may be that this rootstock also has some other further genetic issue, which has arrived now, which wasn't there before. It's very, very difficult to be absolutely sure. And as so often, these things have multiple causes. But it means that really significant amount of vineyard is having to be replanted, especially young vines where they don't have the deep root systems. And there are some other diseases of the vine which are a little bit worrying at the moment. So it's worse than bad weather conditions 1 year, because if your vine dies, you've lost your working implement. If you have a bad year, you've just had a bad year and you hope for better next year. So people are having to think hard, and happily, there is a good and positive spirit, and people are really looking for solutions and they're grouping together to work on it together. So we're still a little way away from having solutions that we can feel confidence in, but everything is being done to try to head in the right direction there.
Well, there's an awful lot going on, I'm sure. How worried are the producers, do you think?
It depends on their temperament. Some of them are worried in showing it. Some of them are worried in not showing it. And I would worry about those who weren't worried. No, I mean, you know, we should get through. If global warming continues to develop at an increasing rate, then the phrase I use is that it simply isn't going to matter to us where our next glass of Burgundy comes from. We're going to have many worse worries on our minds. So it could be that the whole thing is, you know, game over in the next 20 years. I don't think that's going to be the case. And I think everybody is responding in as intelligent a way as they can to make sure that they find solutions to come out. I think it is true that the vines are learning, now that they're getting regular hot, dry vintages, they're learning what the game is. And the results are nothing like as sort of violent as they were in 2003. But this brings us on to a slightly different point, and it brings us more into the cellar. But what is the effect of these new conditions on how the grapes ripen? We've been used for a long time, since the turn of the century, to the fact that Chardonnay, you've got to get your drinking, not your drinking window, but your picking window exactly right, simply because Chardonnay, more than Pinot Noir, can put on sugar rapidly as you reach ripeness and then go into overripeness. And it used to take a little bit of time, and you could book your harvest date and maybe not have to move it too much. That's not true anymore. You've really got to be watching it from 2 to 3 weeks before you think you're going to start picking, and do regular taste and sugar analysis tests, and be prepared to go earlier if need be. So that was already on board. From 2018, and it really is a very clear turning point, reds start to struggle as well in terms of their picking window. Now, what I mean by that is that the fruit is starting to ripen too quickly, in the sense the skins are beginning to wrinkle, and you're getting raisiny or pruny or other forms of cooked flavors. The French talk about figuier or flétri. Flétri means the skin is wrinkling. And now, normally, as soon as you suspected that was about to happen, you would start picking. But you need the grape to be physiologically ripe. And in the early ripening areas, that's not happening. We really saw it in 18, not so much in 19. I'm seeing it again in 2020. You can get a position in which you've got these overripe flavors, which we don't particularly want. And alongside that, you've got aggressive, raw, underripe tannins. So with aromatics you don't want, fruit profile you don't want, and a structure that's harsh, you know, you're going nowhere. So people are going to have to be a lot more intelligent about their picking dates. They're going to have to change their canopy management a little bit more to protect the grapes. They're really going to have to think about ways they can slow down ripening. If you replant, which of course you need to do if your old rootstock died, if you replant, you're going to use now for the first time a late ripening rootstock. And indeed, if you're using clones, a later ripening clone. Whereas in the past, you're always looking to do everything for early ripening. So, you know, the generals fight the last war and they've got to learn what the new war is. So there are things that you can do. And secondly, once you've got your, we're still talking reds here, once you've got your grapes into the cellar, you can probably modify your vinification techniques. You extract less, you do much less of the punching down, French called pigeage, partly because in a year like 2020, you've got these incredible colors in the first 24 hours. And you know the wines I've been seeing in the last few weeks, tasting the 20s, I've probably never seen such consistently deep colors as we're getting now. So you do much less extraction. You can probably shorten your vatting time. You use, as long as you're happy that your crop is healthy, you maybe start vinifying without sulfur. The sulfur also both leaches out more things and makes things slightly harsher. And in particular, you can, if you wish to, move to using more whole bunch, whole cluster vinification. Now, you have two wins and a loss if you do that. The loss is that most people reckon that using whole bunches reduces your acidity in the wines, and you're already probably a little bit low in acid. The two wins, the wines taste as if they've got more acidity, oddly enough. They taste fresher. And you also blow off a little bit of more alcohol during the fermentation process. So you've got a slight depreciation in alcohol, which is great. You've got a fresher feel to it, which is great. But actually, you've got lower acidity, which is less great. And you need to feel comfortable about it. You need to feel this is a style of wine that you want to do. And if you suddenly change from always destemming to having lots of stems, you're going to change the style of your wine completely, and you may lose your current customers. So it's something to be studied, and you need to feel comfortable with it. But quite a few people who didn't really use whole bunches are now using a proportion in their wines. A refrain you hear from time to time is, I want them to do their job, but not to the extent that you can taste them. So that's quite a lot of change on the winemaking front. But again, Burgundy is a place which discusses much more than it used to. There are groups that get together and have little technical powwows, people tasting each other's cellars in a way that they probably used not to do. And I think Burgundy is in a really healthy place in that regard, but obviously with a few real challenges to surmount. In the case of the whites, it remains true that you need to pick at the right time. In certain years, 2014, 2017, you actually have wider windows because the sugars weren't galloping. And that's why those two are amongst my very favorite white Burgundy vintages. In other years, it's trickier. Oddly enough, these last three hot vintages, meaning 18, 19, 20, the acidities have been better than you might expect. And we're still trying to work out why. One theory is that in the early ripening vintages, you have a bit more protein in the juice, and that protein contains a sort of acidity which is masked by the protein. So you not only don't taste it, but you don't measure it, and then it comes out during the fermentation process. That's a possible. It could be the fact that the concentration of the grapes through the sunshine, the heat, means that you're concentrating everything. You're concentrating flavor plus sugar plus acidity. And it probably works better with Chardonnay than it does with Pinot, because we already know from the experience of California and parts of Australia that you can make blindingly wonderful Chardonnay at 15 degrees, 14 and a half, 15, in the way that you can't with Pinot. So Chardonnay is growing up. And in fact, since I'm now in the middle of tasting the 2020s, I think we're hitting another really, really fine vintage for white Burgundy, which is encouraging. They need some love after some years in the wilderness. It's true also that these hotter, drier years are changing a little bit the sweet spots in vineyard terms. So I'm liking less those sort of well-drained early ripening sites, and I'm liking more sites which tended to be rather heavy for the whites, or have rough, rustic tannins for the reds because the soils were a little bit too humid. So that would be the lower part of Chassagne-Morichaux, the area called Morgeau. That would be Pommard, maybe Alas Corton, sort of the back end of the sort of hidden away side of Chevry-Chambertin. All those areas which I think are doing well out of this level of global warming. And Pommard is just hitting a wonderful straight of exciting wines, 18, 19, 20. Whereas Volnay, it's not all of Volnay, but certain vineyards in Volnay, you can actually see the stress from too much heat and drought.
That's absolutely fascinating, Jasper. I mean, in the second edition, I mean, it's almost unbelievable. You cover 1,200 vineyards, 300 wine villages, and appraise 700 domains.
It's not enough, Sarah. It's not enough.
I really wish you'd do Beaujolais, Jasper. I'm a great lover of Beaujolais. Hurry up.
Not just Beaujolais, but also there are so if you cover 700 domains, there are 100, let's say, that everybody agrees are great. There's another 200, which everybody would expect to see included. But then after that, for the ones I do include, there are probably others just as good who didn't get in for whatever reason. So but maybe on my website, I'll have more of a chance to give them an outing.
And I think we must mention that to Wine Conversation listeners. I'm sure most of you do know and hopefully subscribe, but if you don't, you really must, to Jasper's brilliant website, which is Inside Burgundy. You must go there. But Jasper, over those 11 years, and as you said, you covered far, far more. What were the biggest surprises? Was it the vineyards? Was it a particular domain? Was there anything that stood out and you thought, my gosh, I never thought I'd write that?
Well, my wife would like me to say, I never thought I'd write another book. But the problem with this book is sort of a life sentence, because it is meant to be, more than just a point in time. It is meant to be something that people can keep and use as a long-term guide. It will at some point or other need redoing. Whether I will have the strength and health and energy to do it, I don't know. But you've caught me out a little bit with that question. There are certainly some things which I didn't foresee how Aligoté would have leapt forward the way it has. There's now this group called the Aligotés who are majoring on it. And we're seeing lots more single vineyard Aligotés. We're seeing also people, because you can mess around. You're not risking too much. If you want to play with sort of fancy techniques, you can afford to do it on a wine that doesn't retail too expensively. But you don't want to mess up your Meursault or your Morochet. So with the Aligotés, some people are playing around with skin contact, not to the extreme extent of an orange wine. But nonetheless, a wine which is macerated for well on its skins, I'm hugely in favor of that, simply because a red wine without skins wouldn't be a red wine. We would miss everything that wine is about. So I'm in favor of trying to have some element of the skin in use in the white grapes. And it has been one of the problems, and a partial cause of the premature oxidation was that people were making their white wines much too clean. And not using, pressing them very cleanly, not using the solids that come out at the end of the press, and trying to make a sort of refined and elegant Chardonnay to match the wonderful elegance of great Pinot Noir. But Chardonnay isn't a ballerina. It's out there playing rugby. It's muscular. I think you need to make the wine with that in mind. And there are a couple of people beginning to do it. I have a sort of complete and utter revelation in the book, except there are one or two nice little things. If you look on page 28 and look in the note in the sidebar, you'll find an interesting fact about Dr. Jules Guyot, the person who gave his name to the type of training of the vines, but it's nothing to do with viticulture. I'll leave you to look that up later.
I look forward to it. I'm very interested in premature oxidation because 11 years ago, everyone was talking about it. It was a massive issue. And it is hardly referred to today. Has it gone away?
No, but nearly. It's been tamed. I don't think the underlying fundamentals which caused it have been completely understood. And if you haven't completely understood them, then of course you can't completely combat them. But people have got a lot better in various different directions. There's less of a tendency to clean the wines up so much they lose their antioxidants. There is much more attention paid to checking how much oxygen is going into bottles in the first place. Because it turned out when people really looked and analysed what their filler heads on their bottling machines were doing, there was a huge disparity. So there's much better equipment in that aspect. And the way you can knock it on the head, even if you haven't stopped all the reasons behind it, is by changing your closures. So screw caps don't really work in Burgundy. The French aren't ready for them, and several other markets aren't ready for them. But moving from cork to diam, or improving the quality and the size of your cork plus waxing the bottle afterwards is another probable solution. Though DM may be more effective. I can't love them, those technical corks, but I do accept that they make a difference. It's rare now that I see, but it does still happen. The wines are less affected and fewer of them are affected, but it hasn't completely gone.
Vintages. Obviously, yes. You are tasting all the time, you're retasting all the time. Can you tell the Wine Conversation listeners which vintages are giving you the most pleasure now for drinking, and which ones would you recommend they just lay down?
Right. Well, first of all, on the drinking, if you look at whites, 17s are some of the best ones are actually tightening up a bit. But in general, 17 is a wonderful vintage, good to drink. 16 and 13, both right to drink now, but they're not in the top class of vintages, but now is the time to drink them. Anything younger than that, I wouldn't drink now, apart from the sort of very basic generic end. I would rather keep 15 because I think there's a potentially great upside. 14 is the best vintage of all of that decade, but it's really tightened up. And if you've got the better quality wines, then I would definitely want to keep them longer because I think it's marvelous vintage. And I like to drink my white burgundies with a decent amount of age, and there is such a strong upside in 14, totally different in style from 15, which is much sunnier, but they're both great vintages. 12 you can drink now. 11 is absolutely perfect now. 10s also, they developed a little bit of extra aromatics through a small amount of noble rot that was around. It wasn't huge, but I probably would be looking at drinking 10s and 11s more than keeping them. And nines, either people picked a little bit late, in which case the wines have always been ugly, or if they pick them early, they're utterly magnificent, and they can be drunk now or kept. But for keeping, then 14, 15, 17, I think 18s deserve a better reputation than they've got, and they will put on weight. It was a very big crop, is why people tended not to recognize it as a potentially good vintage. So I would keep them. 20s, I think, are going to be wonderful and keepers. I haven't mentioned 19, which is slightly riper than my palate personally enjoys. But if you're happy with a riper style of fruit, so if you like your California Chardonnays, for example, then 19 is very much in that mold and very good. And actually, there's no reason why you shouldn't drink it straight away, but they'll keep too. So that's the whites. In the reds, then don't touch 18, 19, 20, apart from the baby level. 17, which we didn't decry, but we said it's a very nice vintage, but it's not one of the great ones because the crop is too big and the wines are that bit lighter. They've put on weight. They're absolutely lovely. In bone restaurants, you're very lucky if you can get anything as old as 17 nowadays, but where you can, I mean, it's an automatic choice for me. We had a most gorgeous village Vendôme Romanée last night. So. Top stuff. 16, I'd be inclined to keep. I believe in that vintage. 15s, there's an opulence about 15, which means that you can drink them young, but there's also a potential upside, which means that I would normally prefer to keep them. 14, a little bit angular, and 13, too. I probably prefer 13 over 14 at the moment. Neither is quite ready, but they're not too far away. 11, 8, 7 are all nice vintages, but not super special, but good to drink now. And 2010 has never stopped being good to drink and will go on being good to drink and is utterly lovely. So 10 and 17 would probably be my first picks.
Well, I think that's absolutely fantastic advice, and thank you for that. Value in Burgundy. Wine value. Can you get it?
Speak up.
Sorry, Jasper. The word value. I know it doesn't.
No, you can. You absolutely can still get value. I mean, it's at a higher price. But the secret for me is to look for the people who are the best in their category rather than saying, I need to have this sort of class of appellation. I must have Grand Cru, must have Premier Cru, I must have Vendôme Romanée or Meursault or whatever. But go to some of the lesser appellations and then find the people who are knocking the ball out of the park, as they say. So Montelly in red. Saramat, some reds, but also in whites. Haute-Côte is becoming really interesting now. There are loads of little corners of the Mâconnais where people are doing the most exciting stuff for not very much money and not getting recognition. Because if you go to a restaurant with a fancy wine list, they'll have 25 different Chablis, one Mâcon, one Saint Véran, one Puy-Fuissé. And Puy-Fuissé is doing great stuff at the moment. And Puy-Fuissé is a great place for very good wine that's more expensive than just cheap, but it's not ridiculously expensive. And then some of the little Mâcon village wines that are around, you know, not the bulk produced ones, but the small growers and the outlying villages can be gorgeous. So I would look to all those for value. The whole of the Chablis district remains very good value, but the wines are becoming warmer there, and they're still really good wines. But if you like the classical, more austere Chablis, then we could be moving away from that. But some of the outlying areas, the sort of Bourgogne Côte d'Auxerre in both colours, Bourgogne Épinoy in red, those sorts of things, Bourgogne Chitry, both colours but more white. There's some nice stuff there, and Vézelay.
I have to say, I'm hugely impressed with some of the wines coming out of Mâcon. They're just getting better and better. Now, the most important question, where can we buy your book?
It depends what country you're listening in.
Well, the Wine Conversation listeners are so far from 92 different countries, so I won't ask you to say them all. But what you can do
is you can either look on my Inside Burgundy website without having to subscribe to get to this information. It will have the list of stockists. Also, the Berry Brothers and Rudd, so www.bbr.com, their website will have the list of, our partners, because we have gone through wine partners and not through book trade, which worked very well for the first edition. So we don't have them in every country. But anyway, Berry Brothers is your link within the UK, and also their website will tell you where you can find it elsewhere, or my website. Please go and search it out. And I'm going to boast now, but just to say that we actually, in terms of selling through to our partners, we had sold out of all 9,000 copies before even the launch date. Our partners should still have stock through to Christmas and beyond, but we rushed back to the printers to get another one going.
Well, huge congratulations. And I have to say, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. I'm really not. Jasper, it's been absolutely wonderful to talk to you today. Thank you. That has been the most fabulous conversation. I am sure that Wine Conversation listeners will be rushing out to find your partners and get the last few books, because I hope it won't be out of print too long. And a reminder that Jasper, of course, has his website. It's a subscription website. It has everything you want to know on Burgundy. I cannot recommend it highly enough. And of course, he is also appearing on Zoom with masterclasses with 67 Pall Mall. And have you any other big engagements that people can come and meet you at, Jasper?
Well, I have my work with the Auspice de Beaune, which is slightly different. So that, of course, is coming out for the Auspice de Beaune sale on the 21st of November. Sadly, very little to sell this year because of the frost, but the wines are looking very exciting, actually. They're looking good. So that is another hat on my head. But I need to cut down some of these hats. But it's all really exciting. And I mean, if you have the good fortune to be paid to work in wine, I mean, why would you ever want to retire?
Quite. Sorry. Thank you, Jasper.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to The Wine Conversation. Just a reminder, if you'd like to order Jasper's book, the stockist details are on his website, insideburgundy.com. And don't forget, there are many other great conversations about wine on thewineconversation.com. Thank you for listening.